Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And you're listening to Key to the Case. We want to give a big thank you to Andrew for suggesting the case we are covering today. I was initially a little intimidated to take it on because of its possible connection to other murders and a disappearance in the same town. But I decided I want to just focus on the case that was requested. And then toward the end, we will discuss the other cases, one of which has had a major arrest recently, but we will not go into great depth. So I will have some recommendations for where you can learn more about those cases if you're interested. So again, thank you, Andrew, very much for your suggestion. And thank you for being a loyal listener and supporter. If you'd like to hear us cover a specific case, you can send us your requests through email. And our email is keytothecase@gmail.com or on Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast. All right. There is a lot to discuss today, so let's dive right in. Jason Ellis was 33 years old at the time of his murder in 2013. Jason grew up in Union Township, Ohio, outside of Cincinnati. He played baseball from a young age, and he was a star catcher for his high school's baseball team. After high school, Jason attended University of the Cumberland, a private liberal arts school located in Williamsburg, Kentucky, where he played on the school's baseball team. When Jason was in college, he met a fellow student named Amy through mutual friends on Valentine's Day in 2001. A big group of friends were hanging out, and Jason and Amy chatted for a while. Amy definitely left an impression on Jason, and I think he left an impression on her, too. After the party, Amy learned that Jason asked another friend of theirs for her phone number. Before Jason and Amy's official first date, Amy learned that her mom, who was supposed to be visiting her, would arrive earlier than she anticipated. So when she was faced with going on the first date or spending time with her mom, she decided to merge the two events. Amy asked her mom if she wanted to go on her first date with them, and she asked Jason if he was okay with that, and they both agreed. I have to say, Jason is a trooper because I don't know if you had asked me before our first date if your mom could tag along if I would have agreed to that. Now, thinking about it retrospectively, that would have been awesome because your mom's great, but it's not what most people have in mind when they meet someone new, but it sure makes for a good story.
Yeah, for anyone who knows my mom, she definitely would have been talking more than me. She's very chatty. I feel like she would have been on the first date with you rather than me being on the first date with you, you know?
Yeah, it would have been a lot of fun, honestly, but it's, yeah, not what you typically expect for a first date. But off they went on their date, and Amy's mom did a lot of the talking. She questioned him fairly extensively, and he seemingly passed all the figurative tests that were being conducted. He even brought flowers to the date for both Amy and her mom. From there, Jason and Amy began a serious relationship. Jason's love for baseball was still at the forefront of his life, and again, he was a talented player. So much so that he played for the Cincinnati Reds minor league team, which fulfilled a dream he always had.
So they dated all throughout college, and then he got drafted after his senior season, I'm assuming, right?
Yes, that's correct. And he played for that minor league team for about 2 years, but he and Amy got married in October 2004, and Amy became pregnant with their first child, a boy, not long after that. Amy had already moved back to Kentucky, where she was from. So she was experiencing the pregnancy without him. And to make matters worse, she experienced complications. And around that same time, Jason's father passed away. So there was a lot going on at that point. Jason made the difficult decision to quit playing baseball and to start on a new path in life. He knew this was the optimal decision for his relationship with Amy and for their future child, too. He settled into life in Bardstown, Kentucky, where he became a police officer in 2006, and he and Amy would go on to have another son a couple of years later. Jason had always wanted to be a police officer. One of his first goals was to be a baseball player, but shortly following after that, he had an interest in becoming a cop as well. Now, if this story wasn't sounding familiar already, I'm sure for some of you, when I said Bardstown, not for Sean, but for some of you listening, when I said Bardstown, it might have rang a bell. Bardstown, Kentucky is a small town that had a population of just under 13,000 in 2013 when Jason was murdered. And it's the second oldest town in Kentucky. It's located about 45 minutes outside of the major city of Louisville, and it's known as the bourbon capital of the world, with bourbon production being crucial to the economy in Bardstown. It sounds cliche, but Bardstown is often described as one of those towns where everyone knows everyone. Jason loved his work as a police officer. He had a special dedication to it, and he was well-liked by his chief and his fellow officers. Many of his coworkers, but also his family and friends, described Jason as a goofy guy. He had a silly side. And from what I could gather, he wasn't the type to take himself too seriously. Not too long before his murder, Jason began working in the drug unit and had the luxury of working with a canine partner, a German Shepherd named Figo. Jason was the Bardstown Police Department's sole canine officer. According to former Bardstown Police Chief Rick McCubbin, they did a lot of good work in getting drugs off the street, and he was well on his way to doing more cleaning up of drugs in Bardstown. But during Jason's time as an officer, the majority of his work in the drug unit was related to lower-level dealers. He had not taken down any major drug operations, nor was he on the brink of taking one down. And I will be mentioning Rick McCubbin a lot, so just remember he was the Bardstown police chief at the time of Jason's murder. Overall, Jason was an exceptional officer, and he was granted the Officer of the Year award after just 2 years on the force. On Friday, May 24th, at about 5:40 p.m., 33-year-old Jason was on duty, but his son had a Little League game and he was one of the coaches, so he stopped by the game briefly. It was no surprise to learn that Jason coached his son's Little League team. I'm sure that was a fun and rewarding experience for him. Amy, who was at the game, indicated that she didn't get to speak with him much because he got dispatched to a domestic call just about 10 minutes after he arrived at the game. He left the game in a hurry without saying goodbye to anyone. After he handled the call, he returned to the game briefly before he had to leave again. Amy attempted to call Jason after the game, but he didn't answer the call, so she assumed he was too busy to talk. At 11 p.m., he called Amy back, which woke her out of her sleep. They chatted for just a bit, and he explained that it had been a really busy shift, but nothing too crazy. At midnight, Jason got a call from dispatch about a drunk and disorderly man. The man also needed medical attention because he had fallen in the street. EMS transported the individual to the hospital where he continued to cause trouble. Jason had to go to the hospital to handle the drunken man, and then he was required to take the man to the Nelson County Jail after he was medically cleared. So after Jason dropped this man off at the jail, he wrapped up his shift. And I should note that he didn't have his typical canine vehicle that night. It was being worked on, so he had a spare police cruiser. Jason left the jail and called off duty at 1:59 a.m. at which point he got on Bluegrass Parkway to head home. More specifically, he headed in the direction of exit 34, which would be about a 15-minute drive. And from there, it would take 10 more minutes to get to his home. This was the route he standardly took home after every shift. Exit 34 is a winding exit. So when you first get off on the exit, you can't see the end of it. And then the two-lane country road you end up on after the exit is actually above Bluegrass Parkway. It bridges over Bluegrass Parkway. I was able to see the exit on Google Earth, which was instrumental in my understanding of this location because it's important to this case. And I just showed it to Sean as well.
Yeah, we just paused and Sam showed me the exit that Jason took. There was a lot of brush on either side of the exit that he took, as well as what appeared to be rock walls, I guess is the best way I could describe it. Pretty much following the road of the exit that Jason took. So if you're able, pausing right now and trying to check that exit on Google Maps or Google Earth, sounds like it's going to be pretty helpful in the case.
But if not, hopefully we did a good enough job describing it. I also think it's worth mentioning that there's no overhead lighting in this area, so drivers rely on their headlights to illuminate the road in front of them at night. So Jason took this exit at around 2:15 a.m. As he went around the curve, he spotted brush in the roadway. He turned his cruiser lights on to move what were later learned to be freshly cut tree limbs to the side of the road. As he went to move the branches out of the road, he was shot repeatedly with a 12-gauge shotgun. Jason was undoubtedly ambushed. That night, Jason wore a bulletproof vest, and that vest was struck multiple times. He was then struck below his armpit. Another blast rang out from the shotgun, at which point a different size and type of pellet was fired. He was hit on his right upper arm, his forearm, and his right elbow. A third and final shot was fired, and the pellets hit him in the scalp, jaw, and temple. This is one of the most heinous murders I've heard of. It doesn't have the personal component that you see with a stabbing or blunt force trauma, but Jason was hunted as if he were prey, and the level of premeditation here is glaringly obvious. According to a 2014 article from Cincinnati's ABC 9, quote, "The shotgun pellets that hit him are those typically used for hunting small animals, target shooting, and skeet or trap shooting, also known as clay pigeon shooting, not for killing a man," end quote. Jason had zero opportunity to defend himself or to take cover, and he died a rather quick death. Several minutes later, two cars took exit 34, unknowingly about to see something I can imagine they'd never forget. The first car was a Toyota Corolla packed with four passengers, an inebriated woman in the passenger seat, her boyfriend, and a child sat in the back seat, and the car was driven by the woman's 19-year-old son. Not far behind the Corolla was a man who worked for a local distillery. He was on his way home from work. When he saw the Corolla parked on the exit, as well as the police cruiser, he got out of his vehicle to investigate when he made the grisly discovery. He urged the people in the Corolla to try to contact someone with Jason's police radio while he checked Jason's vitals, but there were no signs of life. The intoxicated woman who was in the car spoke into the police radio to let dispatch know that there was an officer down at 2:40 a.m. Officers arrived soon after to discover not only their coworker, but their friend dead. They knew they had to deliver the news to Amy as soon as possible. And Amy described the shock, the horror, and some of Amy's first thoughts were, how will I go on without him? How can I raise the boys without him? But then to learn that Jason was ambushed added another layer of shock and horror to this nightmare. I think the first assumption would be that this occurred while he was on duty. So to learn that it didn't was surprising in itself. An investigation ensued immediately with the Kentucky State Police at the forefront of that investigation. They learned that the debris or freshly cut tree limbs that were placed in the road were not from the direct area in which Jason was murdered. Someone traveled to where they would murder Jason with the debris in their car or in their arms, knowing exactly what they were about to do.
So Jason was essentially targeted, right?
It seems that way, yeah, but I don't know how that could be proven without knowing who killed him.
Yeah, it just seems like someone learned what his route home was every night and seemed like they devised a plan to get him to stop so they could follow through with this murder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. If Jason were murdered on some random road that he never drove on, then this would be a completely different story. But I think because you can factor in that this was his regular route, it does seem targeted. But we'll get into that more. So the debris at the scene was tested for DNA as well, but it's unclear if there was any DNA left behind. I think they were hoping maybe the person who handled it slipped up and forgot to wear gloves. A nearby pond was searched in hopes of finding the shotgun used in the murder after a dog hit on the pond, but they found nothing. The approximate location of the shooter was determined pretty early on. And as you described, Sean, they're kind of like these rock walls or cliffs on the both sides of the road where Jason was killed, and there's a ton of brush. So one would have no problem being completely concealed, not only by the brush, but by the darkness that night. Police found evidence of where the shooter had been hiding because there was kind of a flattened spot found and some shells were left behind. So the shooter was standing atop one of these rock walls, which gave them a clear view of Jason. And I keep saying shooter, but there is a possibility that there was more than one shooter. So just keep that in mind. When I say shooter, that could also mean two shooters. In fact, many people believe that there was more than one person involved, which wouldn't necessarily have to mean more than one shooter, but possibly even a getaway driver.
I thought you mentioned a couple different types of ammunition. So that would lead me to assume that there were a couple shooters, more than one at the very least. Or if it was one shooter, they may have brought a couple different guns.
Yes, good catch on that. I think either of those could be possibilities. And let's take it back a step and just walk through the possibilities of if it were a lone shooter or multiple shooters. So first, let's just say it was one person. The person could have parked on the side of the road above, or they could have pulled off in the grass to park. They committed the murder and drove off. The problem with this option is that the killer would risk their car being seen by a witness. It was late at night, but if you consider how much planning they likely put into the murder, you'd think they would not want to leave their car out in the open.
It does seem like they put some thought, not some, it seems like they put a lot of thought into how this was going to go down.
Oh, yeah.
So I would probably assume that they scoped out the road that he was taking back home every night, and they got some sort of feel on how much traffic was actually going through that road every night. So they could have parked their car somewhere where they knew it was not going to get seen.
Yes, like somewhere more secluded.
Or maybe not even secluded, maybe just off the side, because you mentioned it was a country road. I don't know how much traffic is going through there. It's a pretty small town, so maybe it wasn't a very high traffic area. So they may have just pulled off the side of the road just based on whatever surveillance they did in the weeks prior, if they did do that much.
Yeah, I would say it's not super well traveled at this time of night from my research. But then again, you do have two cars that came upon Jason's car in a matter of 10, 15 minutes after he was killed. So there's some traffic, right? But we also don't know how long the person was waiting there. If they were targeting Jason, how long were they waiting? How do they know exactly when he would be there? Again, were they privy to his actual shift? Exactly what time he would get off on which day? A lot of questions here. But I think that is a second option, though, that they parked farther away, not right off the road. But again, the problem with that theory would be someone could have witnessed them walking and walking with a gun and tree limbs.
Yeah, but that person could have laid those tree limbs on the side of the road, like very, not very far off, but, you know, right on the side of the road to get ready for that night that they murdered Jason. They could have laid them off all neatly and made them look inconspicuous.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, they could have put even more planning into this and set the branches there. It wouldn't even have to be on the side of the road, I guess. It could have even been at that top of that rock wall. And then all they would have to do when they get there is set the limbs in front of the, or in the road.
Yeah, and they could have even hidden the guns too. I don't know if they would have want to do that, but they could have.
Yeah, that's a possibility. If they were walking, I think, well, if they were parking somewhere else and walking, I think doing that beforehand wouldn't be so far-fetched. It might be a little risky, but people aren't hanging out in this area. This is not somewhere where someone would stumble upon the guns and the tree limbs.
Yeah, you kind of split the risk. I mean, if they didn't hide the guns, then they would have had to walk with their guns to the point of the attack and then walk back. But this way, if you hide them, you only have, you're taking out half the risk because you're just having to walk back, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. And there is a residential property near where the murder took place, pretty close by. And those homeowners didn't see or hear anything that night. And I called those both lone shooter scenarios. It is possible that there were two shooters who arrived in the same car or walked from the same location. The third option is that the shooter was dropped off by a driver who then circled back to pick them up after the killing. But I do want to entertain the possibility of there being more than one shooter. The wound patterns on Jason's body and the spread indicated shots being fired from different positions. I've seen it explained in a few places how the pattern and spread ended up as it did, but the Bardstown podcast did a great job of laying this out. So it could be that Jason's position changed, right? He is moving, so the spread and the wound patterns are changing. But it's more likely that the shooter made advances toward Jason and or they changed their own position while they advanced. Alternatively, if there were two shooters firing from different locations, that could provide the varying wound patterns and spread. This kind of tactic could be an indicator of someone who's familiar with hunting or has a military background, which isn't an especially helpful indicator or clue considering many people in Bardstown take part in hunting. So there are so many possibilities as to how this could have played out and which scenario is most likely. It seems to depend on who you ask. In an interview Rick McCubbin did with Investigation Discovery's Real Life Nightmare, he stated that he believed the Kentucky State Police thought it was a two-person operation because of the layout. But as time has gone on, he feels the possibility of a lone shooter is just as likely. Jason's mother-in-law, on the other hand, has been open about her opinion that there was more than one person involved in Jason's murder and that he was specifically targeted. Talked about it a little bit. I concur that this was most likely a targeted murder. Although with the information we have, I don't know how you could prove that, but it appeared that this was targeted. Someone wanted Jason dead. So some of my first questions would be, who would be acquainted with Jason's schedule and his route home, and who would benefit from Jason's death?
I kind of hate to say it, but my mind is somewhat leading to someone on the inside. I mean, they would know when Jason is getting off work. They would know his route home, most likely. But on the other hand, radio scanners are also pretty available. But I mean, you would have to know what Jason's route home is. If even if you had one of those, if you're a citizen and just had one of those police scanners, you would have to have done some surveillance on how he gets home. So I guess with all that said, I'm pretty split on whether it was someone on the inside or if it was just some random person. Although it would not be too far-fetched to assume that it was, you know, a fellow cop, because they would know exactly when he's getting off, exactly where his route home was leading. But yeah, I, on the other side, like I've already said, someone, anyone could have gotten a police scanner and done some surveillance and knew what his route home was going to be right after he got off work.
Or even without the police scanner, they could have just been following him and realized he typically gets off at this time, so he'll probably be there. But I agree. I don't think it's too far-fetched to think that a fellow police officer would be familiar with Jason's schedule. There are few other people who would be outside of his family, and we know his family was not involved.
Yeah, but I guess the question is, who would want to kill him?
I don't know. And that's the problem. So there's been nothing in Jason's personal life that could be tied back to his murder. He didn't have issues with people in his life. So you're left with his work. And the police chief has had some choice words for people who have tried to suggest this at all, which we'll get into. But I don't think it's too wild to question it. Right? We have to think, if this is targeted, someone was familiar with the schedule, someone knew his route home, period. Has to be one of those possibilities. Someone followed him, that's another possibility. Moving on to the second question, who could have benefited from Jason's death? I think this can go a couple of routes. There could have been someone who had something to gain from his death. So something pretty tangible, or there could have been something that was prevented from happening by Jason's death. Regarding the first option, I don't have any tangible benefits to share with you. In my research, I could not find any examples of how someone could benefit financially from his murder or at work. It's not like with Jason gone, someone would get a big promotion.
Okay, so you mentioned that Jason was in the drug unit, and that he arrested some of the lower level distributors. I mean, maybe this could be some sort of retaliation tactic that someone higher up on the, you know, drug distribution scale sought out because he had some of his distributors arrested and now he's taking a hit on his business or her.
Yes, that theory is talked about often in this case. I think it's a natural one. Again, we're going back to his work. Most people, if they're murdered, you're not going to be looking at their work as to the cause of their murder. But with a cop, it's totally different. And I think it's a plausible theory. But investigators sorted through every arrest Jason had made, and they couldn't come up with a single connection to his murder. That doesn't mean it's ruled out. It just means that they couldn't find anything that could prove that any one of those people or anyone they were connected with was involved in his murder.
So did they interview the people that he did arrest?
Yes, I think everyone that they could get in contact with, yeah.
And they didn't give up anything, right?
Right. In March 2014, about 9 months after Jason's murder, a Bardstown police officer named Tony Satterly was indicted on 10 counts of obtaining or attempting to obtain prescription drugs by fraud, forgery, or misrepresentation. The first article I read about this was pretty vague, so I assumed that he was obtaining Schedule II drugs with fake prescriptions. But then I went to the second article I could find about this matter from WLKY in September 2014, and more details were divulged. From January 2013 to January 2014, Satterly filled prescriptions for a total of 1,825 hydrocodone pills and 265 oxycodone pills. These prescriptions came from 5 different physicians, and most of these were filled at a local Bardstown pharmacy. Satterly was a patient at just one of these offices, and another Bardstown police officer had a girlfriend named Christy who worked at this doctor's office. Some of his prescriptions were received through Christy. Satterly claimed that he thought this was all above board and that Christy was talking to the doctor who would then write the prescriptions for him. He even obtained some of the prescriptions at the memorial for Jason Ellis. Christy had her own claims. She stated that there were prescription pads that had the doctor's signature, and it was up to the staff to write it out based on notes in a patient's chart, which doesn't even make sense considering it didn't sound like Satterlee was making regular visits to this doctor. The doctor said he, quote, didn't recall authorizing or approving those prescriptions. They were not valid, end quote. Christy was indicted on 2 counts of forgery of a prescription. Reality is they both knew what they were doing, both coming up with these claims that don't make any sense. So I know that's kind of a detour, but it's an interesting detour. With the large number of pills Satterlee received, I wondered if he was distributing as well, but I couldn't find any reports that they were for anything other than for personal use from a back injury he sustained.
So were any of the arrests Jason made in relation to anything to do with hydroxy?
I don't exactly know. There were pictures of him with marijuana that he had confiscated, but I would imagine there were pills as well involved in the work he was doing. What I do know is that there's no evidence that Jason was aware of Satterlee's drug addiction or that he obtained the prescriptions in the manner he did. And Rick McCubbin squashed rumors early on that Satterlee's situation could be related to Jason's murder. And Rick has generally dismissed the notion that an officer of the Bardstown Police Department could have had a hand in Jason's murder, even going so far as to call it an idiotic idea. And to take it even further, he said to the Courier-Journal in May 2014, quote, "I want to choke the living shit out of people when they say it," end quote. Full transparency, I just had to re-record that quote about 3 times because it felt so weird saying that, so far from anything I would ever say. And in my opinion, Rick needs to take a step back and look at this from a perspective that is different from his own. Many people disagree with his position. And look, I don't see direct evidence that someone in law enforcement murdered Jason, but we do know that no evidence was found to support someone in Jason's personal life being responsible. He didn't have any problems with anyone. So you're left with his work, and that leaves either someone he arrested, as you suggested, or multiple people he arrested, his work with drugs, that would be related to that as well, or a fellow officer. Who would be more likely to know Jason's schedule? And Rick has been very vocal about Jason's murder. He's done a lot of interviews, which is great, and I can tell he cares. It's much better than if he were to stay silent, but some of his comments can be perceived as quite aggressive.
Yeah, it does seem a little extreme to say something like that. I mean, I'm sure he's gotten pushed over the limit, probably from people repeatedly saying that they think law enforcement has something to do with it. I'm sure that's why he's reacting in such an aggressive manner. It seems a little extreme to word it like that.
Yeah, especially because, look, I think we're pretty logical people in general. It's not as crazy of a theory as there could be. I can think of plenty of more what I would actually consider idiotic theories than the notion that someone in law enforcement could have been involved. And personally, if someone in law enforcement was involved, I don't think Rick knows anything about it. I think he's clueless if someone was involved. So I see your point too. He's probably been pushed so far with this theory. And if he truly believes that law enforcement had nothing to do with it, then of course he's going to be annoyed, but I don't know. I just thought some of the comments were a little much. So, and those leads have seemed to come up dry. I think many people would not be surprised though if there's an arrest in this case one day and it somehow comes back to the work he did. Jason also seemed like the type of person who, if he witnessed misconduct among his fellow officers, he would report it. He could be a threat to someone in that regard. I'm not saying he witnessed misconduct, but if he did, I think he would bring it forward. it's a natural feeling, I think, to want to go back to his work and try to connect it to his murder. There's been some talk about a local gang in the area, the Bardstown Money Gang. Jason had arrested members of this gang before, and one of the members allegedly claimed he was behind the murder. It was determined that the particular individual who was claiming the most involvement in the murder was in jail the night it occurred, so he was ruled out as being responsible.
Yeah, but is there the possibility that he's somehow coordinating it from the inside?
I suppose that's possible. Rick McCubbin said, quote, "We don't believe they had anything to do with it. Of course, nothing is 100% ruled out at this point, as you know, but we don't believe they had anything to do with it. They're trying to empower themselves by making that claim, intimidating people, and using the fear factor that I'm so bad I killed a cop," end quote. This type of murder seems a little advanced and calculated for what you'd expect one of these gang members to be capable of. Could they really have covered their tracks so much so that even when they admit to doing it, they can't be caught? The type of crimes these people have committed, from what I could find, have not necessarily been the discreet type and completely planned out like Jason's murder. It certainly seems plausible that they made these statements to try to boost their reputation in a sick way. And the leader of the gang has stated that they had nothing to do with the killing of Jason. Now, we could spend more time diving into the Bardstown Money Gang, but I think it would be a disservice to our listeners when it doesn't appear they're connected to the murder. The FBI has been pulled into the investigation, which is great for this case, but the Kentucky State Police are still involved in the investigation as well. As I mentioned in the beginning of this episode, in the few years following Jason's murder, Bardstown was struck by several more tragedies. On April 21st, 2014, 11 months after Jason's murder, 16-year-old Samantha Netherland and her mom, Kathy, were murdered in their home in Bardstown. Kathy was shot several times. Samantha had knife wounds, and they both suffered blunt force trauma, and they had their throats cut. Samantha was a sophomore in high school, and she was described as a typical teen. She was known for being quite intelligent, too. Kathy was a special education elementary school teacher, and no one had a bad word to say about either Kathy or Samantha.
Was the type of gun used similar to what Jason was killed with?
To the best of my knowledge, they haven't released what type of weapon was used or what type of gun was used. No one could understand why Samantha or Kathy would be murdered. And reportedly, Samantha received the brunt of the injuries. There was a black Chevy Impala seen on surveillance footage near their home around the time of the murders, but police were never able to find the car or the driver. And to date, there have been no suspects named. There's no known connection between Jason and Kathy or Samantha. Crystal Rogers, a mother of five, disappeared from her home, allegedly, during the 4th of July weekend in 2015. I say allegedly because that story was given by her boyfriend, Brooks Houck, and Brooks has long been considered a suspect in Crystal's case. 5 months after Crystal disappeared, a friend and employee of Brooks was arrested in connection to her disappearance. He was charged with 38 counts of perjury for lying to investigators under oath. And then in August of this year, a man named Joseph Lawson was also arrested in relation to Crystal's disappearance, and he was charged with conspiracy to commit murder and tampering with evidence. Joseph Lawson's father, Steve, worked for Brooks at the time of Crystal's disappearance. So that's the connection to Brooks. And Brooks had a phone call with Steve the night of Crystal's disappearance. Brooks has since been arrested just very recently. So recent, I think at the time of this recording, it was about a week and a half ago. He's been arrested in relation to her disappearance not too long after Joseph's arrest. And he's been charged with murder, as well as tampering with physical evidence. But Crystal's never been found. So they must have Police must have a lot of information to bring forth that charge. I'm really happy to see some resolution coming in Crystal's case. I hope it all goes well and that Crystal is actually found one day. Now, how how does this tie into Jason's case? Well, Brooks has a brother named Nick, and Nick worked for the Bardstown Police Department at the same time as Jason. Nick has since been fired from the police department for impeding the investigation into Crystal's disappearance. He actually encouraged his brother to stop cooperating with the investigation, and he was reluctant to cooperate himself. As far as I'm aware, there's no evidence that's been made public that connects Nick or Brooks to Jason's murder, and there wouldn't be a clear motive, but it's still an interesting connection. Jason was an ethical cop. Could he have been a threat to other officers, not even necessarily saying Nick, other officers who weren't ethical? There was Tony Satterley, who was obtaining prescription drugs illegally and had help from a fellow officer's girlfriend. Not saying that situation is linked to Jason's murder, but not everyone in this police department was squeaky clean, is what I'm saying. It seems like Jason's murder is tied to his work in some way. He didn't have enemies in his day-to-day life. I keep hitting on that point. I don't have anything to back it up necessarily, so that's where my speculation ends, but it seems viable to me. Nick and Jason weren't friends, but Jason was always friendly toward him because that's how Jason was. Rick McCubbin has described Nick as more reserved or introverted. Jason's sisters and mom did a recent interview with WHAS 11, and they expressed how the recent arrest in Crystal's case gives them hope that there could be traction in Jason's case soon. And this was in reference to the arrest of Joseph Lawson, based on the timing of the interview before Brooks was arrested. But I can imagine now they feel even more hopeful since he's been arrested. They acknowledge the possibility that Jason's case is connected, and an arrest in Crystal's case could equate to movement in Jason's case. But they also acknowledge the possibility that they aren't connected. Oxygen produced a documentary about Crystal's case called The Disappearance of Crystal Rogers. And during the season finale, an anonymous prison inmate shared that Jason was killed because, quote, he was close to an investigation of a ring of storage shed burglaries and business burglaries, end quote. Allegedly, the storage units contained high-end antiques and drugs, and that four people were hired to kill him by someone who was not identified. I couldn't find that this claim was ever substantiated, and it seems like the police could have substantiated that if it were true. Jason wouldn't be the only one who knew about what he was on to. On November 19th, 2016, Crystal's father, Tommy Ballard, was murdered on his own property while preparing for a hunting trip with his grandson. One of the property lines is adjacent to the Bluegrass Parkway, but it's about 10 miles from where Jason was murdered. He was shot once and he died immediately.
Do they know what the murder weapon was for that?
No, that has also been, well, they do know, I believe, but that has been kept under wraps. Tommy was extremely active in keeping Crystal's case alive. And the common belief is that Tommy was killed to stop him from probing into her case more, or that Crystal relayed information to him before she disappeared that could have been used against someone. There isn't a known connection to Jason's murder, but they both were killed in kind of this sniper situation, which could be coincidence or could be that someone did it once and thought they could do it again.
So this town was about, what, 12,000 people or so?
Yeah, about 13,000 at the time of Jason's murder.
So, I mean, there's a string of murders going on here that may seem to be related, right? I mean, if it was like a town, or not a town, but a city of a million people, no one would even care. Or, you know, people would care, but no one would attempt to relate these if it was a way larger town or city.
Right. And it's the time period. It was just a span of about 3 years where all of these cases occurred.
Right.
So you couple those two variables and it starts to seem like maybe there could be a connection. And I'll tell you, the sense that I get when I read about this case is that most people think Crystal and Tommy's cases are connected. Actually, I think pretty much everyone believes they're connected. some people believe Jason's case is connected to Crystal and Tommy's case, very few people seem to be fully on board that Kathy and Samantha's case is related to any of the other cases, but a lot of people still acknowledge it.
Yeah, I suppose that's what I'm trying to convey, is that Jason, a cop in this town, was murdered, and then another cop's brother is involved in these other murders, and Nick is being uncooperative with the investigation.
Yeah, to be clear though, Brooks was only involved in Crystal's case. As far as we know, he has not been connected to any of the other cases. So just to make that clear. But I get what you're saying. And what also makes it kind of hard to understand is that it's not like Kathy and Samantha and Jason and Crystal and Tommy all knew each other or anything. Obviously, Crystal and Tommy did, that Tommy was Crystal's father, but there hasn't yet really been connections that can say Jason knew Kathy, who knew Crystal, or anything along those lines. If you want to learn more about these cases, I highly recommend the podcast called Bardstown. I listened to it recently. I thought it was really well done. And there are, I believe, 9 episodes, but it's a pretty quick listen and it gives you more information than we're talking about here. Jason was the first cop to be killed who worked for the Bardstown Police Department. His case deserves to be solved, and I think it will be. I really don't think this is going to be a case that remains unsolved until the end of time. Jason's memory lives on. A month after his murder, the community dedicated a special plaque to him, which serves as a permanent reminder of him. Sadly, Jason's memorial that was set up at the location of his murder was vandalized last year. I don't believe they ever caught the person or people responsible for the vandalism, but it's not necessarily believed to be connected to his murder. Jason's canine partner, Figo, was cared for by Jason's family, and he stayed with Jason's mother-in-law the majority of the time. There's this one really heartbreaking picture of Figo putting his paw on Jason's casket at his funeral, and I'll be sure to share that on our Instagram, but they had a really tight bond. They worked together for 6 years. So I'm sure the loss of Jason was felt by Figo as well. And Figo himself passed on nearly 4 years the day after Jason's murder, and his ashes are stored in an urn, which is placed beside Jason's gravestone. There have been ceremonies over the years on the anniversary of Jason's death. And on the 8th anniversary, his wife Amy said, quote, "We don't ever forget, and we have to go on and live each day. And when people show up to help us honor him the way he should be honored and remembered, it means the world to us. It makes us feel like we're not alone," end quote. She has also described Jason's murder as a nightmare that she has to live with for the rest of her life. Amy has since moved out of Bardstown, gotten remarried, and the boys are in high school now. Although Amy has moved and remarried, she is still vocal about getting justice for Jason. So my heart goes out to Amy and her 2 sons who have had to go on without their father, and his sisters and mom who miss him dearly and are constantly reminded of him, as well as the families of Samantha and Kathy Netherland, Crystal Rogers, and Tommy Ballard. All right, Sean, what are your final thoughts?
I'm still leaning towards what he was doing within the drug unit. I mean, albeit he was only really taking down low-level guys, I think that may have led to a bigger operation. Maybe it wasn't, but if he was being successful in arresting people who were dealing drugs, then there could have been a connection down the line where he would be able to take down some higher level guys.
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I definitely think that's a possibility, a strong possibility, even though they seemingly looked into everyone he arrested. I don't think it can be ruled out. There's presently a nearly $250,000 reward for information leading to the identification, arrest, and conviction of the person who murdered Jason. And you heard that right. That is a huge reward. Unlike the other cases we've covered where you might hear about a $10,000 reward, $25,000. I mean, this is enormous, and his killer or killers still have not been caught. If you have information related to Jason's case, please call the FBI at 502-263-6000 or call the Kentucky State Police Post 4 at 270-766-5078. You can also email tips to ellis.casetips@ky.gov. What a chilling case this is. I have truly never heard of a murder similar to this one, but thank you all so much for joining us for this episode. And thank you again, Andrew, for recommending the case. As a reminder, you can find us on Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast to see photos related to Jason's story and all of the others that we've covered. Also, we'd really appreciate it if you give us a 5-star rating or a review wherever you listen to the show.
All right, that's all for now. We'll be back next week with a brand new case. Bye.
Bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.